I'm Glenn Moberg. This Thursday on Route 51, we preview the Reverend Martin Luther King celebration in Stevens Point with Bill Fulton, who knew Dr. King as a teenager and whose dad marched with him in Birmingham. Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network.
Bill Fulton's father was Robert Brank Fulton. If you look at old pictures of Dr. King leading marchers across the Birmingham Bridge, Bill's father, Brank, is the only white man in those pictures. He was arrested with Dr. King, and Bill will be speaking at the community celebration in Stevens Point this coming Monday evening at Spash High School. We've also got Bill's sister, Liz, who is an associate principal at Spash, and we've got Paul Mertz, who is a professor emeritus at UW-Stevens Point, whose work in history has delved into the entire civil rights era and the role of poverty in the South. Give us a call, 1-800-780-9742.
Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, it's our annual Martin Luther King Day show as we preview a community celebration scheduled for this Monday evening at Stevens Point Area Senior High School, a celebration organized by Justice Works Limited, a nonprofit Portage County organization dedicated to the cause of justice. We have the keynote speaker with us, joining us by telephone from Cleveland, Ohio, William Bill Fulton, an attorney who knew Dr. King as a teenager. And also here in our studio, his sister, Elizabeth Fulton, who is the associate principal at Spash High School and also the principal of the Stevens Point Alternative High School. Bill and Elizabeth's father was Robert Brank Fulton, a courageous man who welcomed Dr. King into their home and then moved to Birmingham, Alabama, where he would participate with King in the civil rights struggle in the early 60s. Robert Brank Fulton taught at an all-black college in Alabama. He was arrested with Dr. King. And if you look at the old pictures of the march across the Birmingham Bridge, look for the only white man in the photo standing right behind Dr. King. That man was Robert Brank Fulton. Also joining us in our studio, Paul Mertz, a professor emeritus of history at UW-Stevens Point, who has specialized in the history of the post-Civil War South, on poverty, and on the civil rights struggle. Dr. Mertz also spent his childhood in Alabama, attending an all-white high school in Huntsville in the 50s. You can join us at 261-6371 if you're in the Wausau area. That phone number again, 261-6371, or toll-free, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. What do you think Dr. King's legacy was? Have we achieved the dream that he had? If not, where are we falling short? And those questions, of course, have particular significance with the election of President Barack Obama as the first African-American president in the history of this country. Let's start out with Elizabeth Fulton, who's in the studio with us. And Elizabeth, why don't you tell us a little bit about Justice Works Limited? You're not only active in both of the high schools in Stevens Point, but you're on the board of directors of Justice Works.
Well, Justice Works was incorporated in 2004. Before that, a group of people had gotten together looking at justice practices and realizing that we weren't always meeting the needs of the victims or the offenders. And so the organization was formed to advance programs and practices of justice to make relationships right with the community, that restorative justice concept.
And you've got a number of high-profile people in the Stevens Point area who are on that board of directors with you.
Absolutely. Judge Fred Flashauer is on the board. We have Mr. Stock is our director. Kitty Monk is our executive director.
And this is the third year now that you've put on a community celebration honoring Dr. King.
Exactly. That's among many other programs that we do, volunteers and probation. among others.
Elizabeth, what do you remember about your father, Robert Brank Fulton?
There's so many memories, I guess, as we're thinking in this light. I think about my dad as somebody who just couldn't stand to see injustice, and he felt like he always needed to address that. And it didn't matter if it was concerned him personally. It did concern him personally, even if it didn't affect him personally. So he really took a stand.
Courageous to be a white man marching with Dr. King across that bridge in Birmingham.
He was very courageous.
Bill Fulton, are you still with us in Ohio?
I am, Glenn.
And Bill, I'm going to ask you the same question. What kind of a man was your father?
Well, he was really, really a unique person, I think. He was someone who, as Lizzie said, just he loved a challenge. He loved to fight for what he thought was right, and he did it to the detriment of his career, to the he lost out a lot because he challenged what he thought was wrong at every point.
Now, he was not only a teacher, but he was a minister. Explain that to me.
He was a ordained Presbyterian minister, but he always wanted to and always taught at the college level. I don't believe he ever had a pastorate, but he did often fill in for other ministers and all at church services, but he was primarily interested in teaching, and he taught religion and philosophy. He was very much interested in world religions and taught that broad area at a number of different colleges and universities.
And you spent some time in China.
I was born in China, as was my oldest sister, Mary. My mother grew up in China, and my dad went out in connection with Yale in China. Yale University had an extension in China, and taught there for a number of years and worked there during the war.
And you were there for a while after the communists took over.
Right. We were there for about a year and a half, I believe, after the communists took over. Of course, I was pretty young, so I don't remember that. But
tell us when you first met Dr. King. That was in Puerto Rico, wasn't it?
Yes. My dad was teaching at a school called Inter-American University in San Ramon, Puerto Rico, and he invited Dr. King to come down to the university and give a series of lectures, and Dr. King accepted. So he came down. This was in 1962, and came down to almost a hero's welcome in Puerto Rico. Everybody knew him and wanted to hear him speak. He stayed with our family for the 4 or 5 days that he was in San Ramon.
What do you remember about Dr. King?
I remember him being a very modest person, he did not have a large ego. I remember we had dinners and breakfasts and lunches with him, and he talked, he was only interested in what we as children were doing and what we liked to do, and he didn't talk about himself at all. He was always interested in the other person. He was a very quiet person.
Did your father get to know him because he was a Presbyterian minister? Was it because of his academic background, or was it because of an interest in the civil rights struggle, or maybe all three?
Well, my father was a member of an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and Dr. King was a member of that organization. But that was sort of just one contact. I think my father just persisted in writing him and convinced him to come down to Puerto Rico. He had been writing him for a couple of years and kept extending the invitation, and Dr. King finally said, yeah, I'll come down.
And that's another example in my mind of, who Dad was in terms of just that persistence in making sure that some things happen. One of the memories I have of him, and I don't know why it sticks so out in my mind, but with Dr. King, is just I remember thinking his hands were so big. Of course, I was young, but there was something about his hands and the gentleness that I remember.
And he convinced your family to move from Puerto Rico to Birmingham?
He convinced my father, and my father convinced the rest of us.
Must have been culture shock.
It was. We went from a very diverse society, which was completely open and obviously a beautiful climate and all that, to Birmingham, which was completely segregated. Everything was segregated. Not only the water fountains and all, but churches were segregated. Hospital waiting rooms were segregated. African Americans could not eat at lunch counters. They could shop in stores, but they couldn't try on clothing. Every mundane aspect of life was segregated.
As a matter of fact, with the churches, we'd said that my father was a Presbyterian minister, and we initially started going to the Presbyterian church. And after it became known that we were living on Miles College campus, which was the black college, we were asked to leave. So we couldn't even go to the Presbyterian church.
Even though you were white, because you were associating with black people, you were asked to leave
yes.
a Presbyterian church, even though your father was a Presbyterian minister?
Yes.
Yes. But then another Presbyterian church, which was sort of a rival, invited us to join, and we did attend services there for the rest of the time we were in Birmingham.
Paul Mertz, you grew up in Huntsville, a different place than Birmingham, but still in the segregated South.
Yes. I lived in Huntsville for about 3 years when I was a high school student. This would be from 1957 to 1960, my freshman, sophomore, junior years in high school.
Yeah, what was your high school like?
I went to Butler High School, which was a rival to Huntsville High School. There were two high schools in town at the time. The city, of course, was growing very rapidly because of all of the military rocket work and the civilian space program.
Huntsville was a big center for the aerospace industry.
Yes, Redstone Arsenal was there. In the 1950s, it grew up very rapidly. People came in from all over the country and internationally as well. And although the schools were still completely segregated at the time that I was there, it was a fairly diverse high school in some ways. It was in a part of the city that had been recently annexed. It had started out as a high school in a mill town called West Huntsville, a cotton mill town.
Mm-hmm.
That had been the previous economy of Huntsville, textile manufacturing. So we had in our school students who came from mill families. We had students who came from army families and had lived in various parts of the world, anywhere that we had military bases, which was a lot of places in the 1950s.
But even with all of those students coming from
yes.
the army, which was integrated,
yes.
The children of their fellow soldiers couldn't go to the all-white high school that you attended.
That's right. Black students from those military families would be assigned to the black schools.
And what was the black school like relative to the white school?
You know, at the time, I had very little idea. And I think at the time, I probably could not have located Council High School in Huntsville. I know since, the Council High School has been closed for a long time, and I know since where it is. It was a very inferior physical facility. It had very little in the way of lab, library, that sort of thing.
That old cliche, separate but equal, simply didn't apply there or anywhere else for that
right.
matter.
That's right. I would see it this way, that if you ask if we observed separate but equal in the South, the answer would be, yes and no. Yes, we observed the separate part. The equal part was ignored, however. So Council was a rather small high school, I think. Again, this is knowledge that I've gained since then from research. The black population of Huntsville was about 10 to 12%, which is not particularly high for Alabama.
We're going to get into the whole question of segregation in the South, how far we've gone, and how maybe we need to learn a little bit still, not only all across America, but right here in Stevens Point, in Wausau, in north central Wisconsin. We're talking about Dr. King Day with Bill Fulton, a man whose father marched with him in the early 60s. Liz Fulton, his sister, is also with us, and Paul Mertz of UW Stevens Point. Only people missing are you. Give us a phone call at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. This is Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're celebrating Dr. King Day a few days early by talking to Bill Fulton, the keynote speaker at a community celebration scheduled for Monday night at Stevens Point Area Senior High School. Bill's dad marched with Dr. King in Birmingham. We've also got Liz Fulton with us, his sister, who is the principal of the alternative high school in Stevens Point, and Paul Mertz, professor of history at UW Stevens Point. Those phone numbers again, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Before the break, Bill, we were talking about high school. What was your high school like? What were your experiences at the time?
Well, I had to go to an all-white high school. I didn't have any choice in it. I went to the high school. People were friendly. Initially, I made friends. I, you know, went to football games and actually went on a couple dates and all. A number of people thought I was kind of strange, kind of weird, because, you know, my dad taught at a black college and we lived on a black college campus. But they kind of shrugged their shoulders and, you know, just took it in stride.
Were you ever threatened because your dad was involved with the civil rights movement, involved with Dr. King? How did that happen?
When my dad was arrested, he was the only white person on the march in Birmingham. And so his name was plastered all over the media in Birmingham on the radios and televisions and papers. And immediately, the whole school turned against me. It was almost everybody. Not only stopped talking to me, but I got beaten up a couple times. I got knocked down. I'd walk in the hallways, and I'd be shoved from behind or from the side.
What was your family targeted by the Ku Klux Klan?
We weren't targeted as a family, but we were.
How about you? Did you have any run-ins with them?
No, not. I had a friend who, or a former friend, who told me that his father was in the Ku Klux Klan and that they were going to come to get me. I don't know quite whether that was true or not,
So there was a threat. You know, that sounds like a threat to me if they tell you they're going to come and get you.
Well, there was a threat. There was a later, much more than a threat. On May 11th, the Ku Klux Klan had a large rally in Birmingham, and they bombed Dr. King's brother's house and church. And they bombed the Gaston Motel, which was the only hotel where black people could stay. It was owned by a black person. And they were driving around, circling the campus of Miles College, where we were staying. And we actually had to all move to the front of the apartment and because the back faced the road. Just for safety's sake, we had to move to the front of the apartment.
Paul Mertz, tell us about the significance of the Klan in the South during that period of time.
The Klan seems to surge at times when racial matters, racial arrangements may be in some kind of change. The Klan, the original Klan, was post-Civil War. It was a terrorist organization. It was rather thoroughly suppressed by the federal government in the early 1870s. Its role in overthrowing Reconstruction is mostly exaggerated in the Southern mind or in the national mind. The suppression of the Klan in that period did not end violence in the South. The violence continued in other channels. There was another organization that was created in 1915 that had no link really to the old Klan of the post-Civil War period. But the Klan created in 1915 and continuing on into the 1920s, when it had its big peak of membership around 1925, was a nationwide organization. It grew into a nationwide organization in the 1920s.
What was the group called?
It was called the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay.
It took the name, disguise, the terrorist techniques in some cases. And it was powerful in the mid-1920s. It had a very rapid rise, hit a peak in the mid-1920s. We don't know how large it was, but it claimed to have 5 million members in
the 1920s. And by the 50s and 60s, with the advent of the civil rights movement?
It declined rapidly in the late 1920s and was sort of down to practically nothing in the 1930s. Surged again in the 1940s, although it did not reach anything like the levels that it had in the 1920s. And there was,
By the 50s and 60s, and
by the 50s and 60s, you had Klan activity breaking out in parts of the South.
And again, that was because of the change in the
civil rights movement.
Because
of desegregation, because of the perception that blacks were getting into unaccustomed roles. And
there was Robert Brank Fulton, a white man,
yes,
thrusting himself in the midst of the civil rights struggle as all that was happening.
Yes.
We've got Robert's son, Bill, with us. We've got his daughter, Liz, with us. We've also got Paul Mertz of UW-Stevens Point. This is Route 51. We're talking about Dr. King. I'm Glenn Moberg. Give us a call, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. We'll have more after this news.
From the Milwaukee Public Museum, hosting the exhibit Dead Sea Scrolls and the Bible, Ancient Artifacts, Timeless Treasures, featuring real scrolls, New Testament papyri, and early Bibles that tell a story 2 millennia long. Info at mpm.edu.
This nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
And we are back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Celebrating Dr. King's birthday a few days early as we look forward to a community celebration that will be held this coming Monday at Stevens Point Area Senior High School, a celebration put on by the organization Justice Works. We have a member of the board of directors of that organization, Liz Fulton, who is also the brother of the keynote speaker, Bill Fulton, whose father
Robert Brank Fulton marched with Dr. King back in the 60s in Birmingham. Also joining our panel, Paul Mertz. He is a UW emeritus professor of history at UW Stevens Point, and we'd like to hear from you. What do you think Dr. King's legacy is? Do we still have a ways to go, even given the fact that we now have an African-American president, Barack Obama? 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Our lines are open for you. Let's talk about that very fact. You know, we now have Barack Obama as president. Did any of you growing up in the South in the 50s and 60s, and Bill Fulton, I'll start with you, did you ever think that could possibly happen?
Yes, I did. I really think this is America, and I thought that could happen. Maybe a little bit later than it actually did happen, but I always thought that was a possibility. And it's pretty great that has happened.
Paul Mertz?
I don't think I could have envisioned that in the 1950s and early 60s. We had not experienced desegregation in Huntsville in the late 1950s. I never went to an integrated school until I was in college. I think the idea of a black president would have been pretty far beyond my imagination at the time.
Yeah, Liz Fulton, we'll let you weigh in as well.
Well, we only spent a year in Birmingham, so we moved around quite a bit, and I guess we were always brought up that, you know, anybody can, you can do whatever it is that you want. So I was excited that we have an African-American president. I was also excited that we had a woman running for president, and it's good news. But I expected that.
Are you surprised, any of you, by the reaction against President Obama by I'll call them a vocal minority in the white community, a minority nonetheless, but they are vocal. The Tea Party signs portraying him with a Hitler mustache or as an African-American, or an African witch doctor, the Nazi swastikas, the hammers and sickles on those protest signs, the people who are claiming that he's not an American citizen, therefore not a legitimate president, that he's a Muslim in league with terrorists. And you even have radio hosts, people like Rush Limbaugh, playing racist songs like Barack the Magic Negro on the airwaves. Are you surprised by the reaction? Bill Fulton?
I'm very surprised that that's taking place in this day and age. I really, really would have thought if people had feelings along those paths, they would have kept them to themselves. And it is very, very disturbing to me that so many people are allowed just to keep spewing that forth on the media, on Fox News and Fox and other media.
They make a lot of money.
They make a lot of money, and that's really a very sad commentary that money counts, you know, on something, on an issue of discrimination and this kind of issue.
Paul Mertz, your reaction to all of this this white anger against Barack Obama?
First, let me say before before we get too far away from the clip that you played of Martin Luther King from the "I Have a Dream" speech, the part that was quoted there, the part that he about one day the sons of slaves and the sons of slave owners will sit down at the table of brotherhood and so forth, is one of the most appealing lines in that whole. In that whole speech, and it appears in several of his speeches.
And we don't have that kind of unity in America today.
No, and we have come a long way. I'm optimistic about a lot of things, but I think no one should underestimate the power of race as an emotional issue in America.
And you mentioned
so
before,
in a way, I'm not surprised that there's a reaction or a backlash against it. I have been extremely distressed, I think, at the level of viciousness of some of it.
And you mentioned before the break that the Ku Klux Klan, as an organization, for instance, would find a resurgence whenever the existing state of race relations was threatened.
Yes.
Here in the year 2010, we have warnings by a group that monitors hate activity, the Southern Poverty Law
yes.
Center,
mm-hmm.
saying that indeed that's happening again, that white supremacist groups are more active than ever and more dangerous than ever, apparently.
That resurgence has been the kind of pattern that we've seen. In the 1950s and 60s, you see this in places throughout the South, not uniformly. What's been said about the Klan in Birmingham is perfectly true. I can remember driving into Birmingham and seeing signs, welcome to Birmingham, by the Rotary Club, by the Kiwanis Club, by the Ku Klux Klan, you know, highway mm-hmm. signs. The Klan was very strong in Birmingham and Montgomery. It did not have a presence in the Tennessee Valley area where Huntsville was located.
And if you want to look at some historical precedents, Senator Robert Byrd was a member of the Ku Klux
yes.
Klan early in his life. He later repented. And the great movie Birth of the Nation in the 20s
yes.
portrayed the Klan in a very favorable light.
Yes. We might also mention here the late Senator and Justice of the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Hugo Black, Senator from Alabama, appointed to the Supreme Court by Franklin Roosevelt, and then it was discovered that he had been a member of the Klan in the 1920s, just for political gain, for political opportunism, you know. And ironically, he turned out to be one of the great civil rights justices of the of our time.
Well, we have spent the last week listening to Senator Harry Reid apologizing for making, you know, what on the face of it appears to be a political observation, that Barack Obama could get elected because he has light skin and doesn't speak with an urban accent. You know, as a political observation, he was probably accurate, but nonetheless, that has become fodder for the last week with calls of racism, calls for him to step down, comparisons to Trent Lott, who said that Strom Thurmond would have made
yes.
a great president on a segregationist platform in 1948. Bill Fulton, your analysis as somebody who spent a lot of time in Birmingham, with the amount of attention that we've been given to Harry Reid's remarks.
Well, I think they're really overblown in terms of what he said. I think they were unfortunate remarks, and I'm a little surprised that he would say anything. They're kind of stupid remarks, really. But I think it's really blown out of proportion. Harry Reid was a strong supporter of Barack Obama from the beginning, and he does evidently has a habit of putting his foot in his mouth, and he did this time. I think we've got to move on from that. It's not the I think Barack Obama has certainly moved on from it, and I think we've got to.
Bill, Paul Mertz was just talking about Hugo Black, who became a great civil
right.
rights justice, even with his background. You had an experience when you were in high school of a young man that you knew whose father was in the Ku Klux Klan, who later did a 180-degree turn. Tell us about that.
Right. The same person I was talking about beforehand, who sat next to me in a class and who was a friend at the beginning of the year, and then threatened me with saying that his father was a member of the Klan and they were going to come and get me and my family. I found out later that only a couple of years later, he had a complete about face, and actually marched on the Selma March, which was a very courageous thing to do. He was disowned by his family. His girlfriend broke up with him. He was ostracized by his friends. And we were told by this one lawyer in Birmingham who knew him and who was trying to help him that he had just been so ashamed of what he had done that he started thinking about things and kind of reversed courses. And, you know, that's what Dr. King was so good at, was changing people's views and changing people's prejudices and getting people to move forward from what was dragging them down in terms of prejudices. And he galvanized the nation in terms of his ability to do that. And his a good part of it was his speech-making ability, but the secondary part was he was able to dramatize the struggle so well with, you know, we can never forget the pictures of policemen in Birmingham, Alabama, and the hoses on kids and the dogs being let loose on young kids. And,
hey, and your dad was right in the middle of all that.
Yeah, well, my dad was in jail while that was happening. Yeah.
And Bill, I mean, don't you think also the power of it being a nonviolent, I remember Dad talking about, you know, before they went out on the march, just Dr. King really emphasizing that it had to be nonviolent and there was, you know, it wasn't anything to be ashamed of if you didn't think you could remain nonviolent if there were police dogs or hoses, then he asked you just please not to go on the march. But I think that power of the nonviolent of how he brought that forward was real important.
That's absolutely right.
We were talking to Bill and Liz Fulton. Their father, Robert Brank Fulton, marched with Dr. King in the 60s. Bill will be the keynote speaker at a community celebration at Stevens Point Area Senior High School this coming Monday evening. Paul Mertz, UW Stevens Point history professor, also with us. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51. Those phone numbers, if you want to join the conversation, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
We're celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy a few days early with Paul Mertz, UW Stevens Point history professor, and Bill and Liz Fulton, whose father marched with Dr. King back in the 60s. Paul, you wanted to pick up on something before the break.
I wanted to pick up on the observation about the Klansmen in Birmingham who made a 180 turn on this. There are some stories in the South about these kinds of people. This is not to suggest that all old Ku Kluxers turn out this way, but I think it is a very interesting example that shows something about redemption and the possibilities of redemption, which is something that Martin Luther King stressed a great deal. And beyond that, I think I'd like to just say this about the significance of King in what is the civil rights movement or the civil rights era in its broadest sense. There are many facets to this, and he was not involved in all of them. There were the young militants who sat in at lunch counters, or those who were freedom riders in 1961 in a very dangerous episode in the South. There was the approach of Thurgood Marshall, the legal strategist and litigator. There were legislators like Lyndon Johnson, even like Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. especially, I think. But I think the thing that makes King preeminent in this period is the fact that he focused America's attention on the moral aspects of this. He was a preacher. He was not sectarian, not excessively sectarian, but from the very beginning, when he came upon the scene in Montgomery in 1955, into a movement that nationwide was already in progress.
He didn't create the movement.
He focused the attention on the movement. And he didn't create the bus boycott. He was sort of drafted into the leadership of that. But always he kept the focus on the moral aspect of this in all of his activities. And I think he did what I think Lincoln talked about in a very different kind of context. He called Americans to what Lincoln called The Better Angels of Our Nature.
One of the things that he focused attention on that he was roundly criticized for was the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And this is an aspect of Dr. King that's often ignored in our high school civics courses. You don't hear the speech very often. So we're going to play a portion of it here. This is Dr. King talking about America's role in Vietnam and calling the United States, and these are his words, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world.
And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. So far, we may have killed 1 million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe?
Dr. King speaking about the Vietnam War, incredibly powerful words. They had an incredible impact and an indication of the fact that this man was not worried about ruffling feathers.
No, that's for sure. I think he knew that he had to speak out, and I think he understood the impact of what he said and who all was listening.
Bill Fulton, what do you think of the stand he took on the Vietnam War in the 60s?
Well, I agreed with it. I was, you know, when I became a little bit older, I went on demonstrations and the March on Washington against the Vietnam War. I thought it was a very, very brave stance because he was at the top of his game in terms of the moral leadership in the country. He was well respected all over the country, with obviously some notable exceptions. And he turned off a lot of people, a lot of his supporters, including Lyndon Johnson.
Well, you can imagine he turned off Lyndon Johnson. But one of the things he said in that particular speech, and I'm paraphrasing him here, was that any nation that spends more money on the military and its wars than it does on fighting poverty and on social justice is a nation that's lost its soul. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that say about America today when we have essentially bankrupted this country over the past 10 years with two wars that we're continuing to fight?
I think he would be very much against both wars. I think he'd be doing everything he could to try to convince President Obama that we've got to end the wars. And I think he would be just as critical of this president as he was of President Johnson.
Liz Fulton, and I'm going to have to bring this back down to earth and back down to Stephen's point because we're down to our last few minutes here. Monday night, we have a number of groups involved at the community celebration, the Dance Education Center, the P.J. Jacobs Junior High Choir, Spash Concert Choir. The national anthem will be sung by the Barber Shoppers, closing remarks by Carol Weston, and you've got Judge Frederick Fleischauer presenting a Justice Works Award to Charlie Fernandez. Tell us very briefly about that.
Right. Charlie is receiving the John Clay Smith Award, which is for volunteer work done in the community, and he definitely exemplifies that. He's the person that the alternative school is named after.
Actually, and you're the principal.
And I'm the principal there. It's the Charles F. Fernandez Center for Alternative Learning. And the reason the students picked his name to be the name of our school is because they knew that Charlie really understands that people have to reach out to meet the needs of students and people, as well, instead of like students coming and having to fit into a particular system. But Charlie's done an immense amount of volunteer work in the community and helped hundreds of people.
When do things get underway Monday night?
7 o'clock is when we start.
Okay. We just heard from three people who will be involved in that celebration. Hope to see you there as well. Bill Fulton will be the keynote speaker. Also his sister, Liz, who's on the board of directors of Justice Works. And Paul Mertz, who is a professor emeritus of history, UW-Stevens Point. Also the keynote speaker at the first ever community celebration in Stevens Point 1 year ago. We want to thank all of them. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks also to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producers, Jane Ritker and Mary Baldwin, and our online producer, Scott Clark. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Dion DeMusi. And a reminder, you can follow our adventures on Route 51 on both Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for riding along with us today. Remember Dr. King on Monday. Until next week, we're heading out of town.
Martin, can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just look around, he's gone home. Didn't you love the things that they stood for? Didn't they try? Find some good for you and me.